This is Frank Gaffney with a word about a truly great American patriot in urgent need. Rich Higgins served in the U.S. Army and as a key civilian Pentagon official and senior strategist on President Trump's National Security Council. After he left the NSC, Rich continued advising Mr. Trump and others about the threats we are facing from enemies, foreign and domestic. He chronicled his experiences over the past 20 years fighting for America First in a terrific memoir entitled The Memo. Now this courageous freedom fighter is gravely ill due to severe complications caused by the Chinese Communist Party virus. He urgently needs help to defray the enormous costs of successive surgeries and a prospective organ transplant. I urge you to join me in contributing to a GoFundMe campaign named Medical Help for Rich Higgins. That's Medical Help for Rich Higgins at GoFundMe.com. God bless you and Rich Higgins.
Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. There is arguably no more contentious flashpoint at the moment in the war for the free world than the Middle East. And I'm very pleased to have with us for our first two segments of this program a friend, a colleague, and a very esteemed expert now on the dynamics of the Middle East. Her name is Dr. Victoria Coates. She has served in a number of senior positions in both the Congress of the United States and the executive branch, including as the National Security Advisor to Senator Ted Cruz of Texas and the Deputy National Security Advisor to President Donald Trump. She has contributed mightily to our public policy debate on these topics and more, notably in her books, David's Sling, A History of Democracy and 10 Works of Art, and in her forthcoming book, Seeing the Light, A History of Christianity and 12 Works of Art, reflecting her PhD in art history, as well as her understanding of the ways of the world. Victoria Coates is these days a very distinguished senior fellow, I'm proud to say, of the Center for Security Policy. Dr. Coates, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. Good to have you. We are speaking to you as your former boss, Senator Cruz, has just returned from a trip to the Middle East, and this provides us both a backdrop for what I wanted to talk with you about today, as well as an introduction to a webinar that I believe the two of you will be having with the Center for Security Policy team probably sometime next week about his travels, among other things. Give us a situation report, if you would, Victoria, about how things stand now in this ever turbulent region as a result, at least in part, of the policies that the Biden-Harris administration has been pursuing for just the past 4 months or so.
Well, Frank, I think we really have to hand it to them. I mean, they've taken their 4 months and really done a number on the Middle East. I think it was very important for Senator Cruz and Senator Hagerty to go over and visit our friends in Israel, who are in a very difficult position, both security-wise and in terms of their internal politics. And so it's a critical moment for senior leadership in the United States to be a reassuring voice for the Israelis that the United States stands with them and that the alliance is unshakable. And unfortunately, we're not getting that out of President Biden or Vice President Harris, and certainly sending somebody like Michael Ratney over there as the acting ambassador is not what you would call a reassuring signal. So that's why I think it was really important to have Senator Cruz and Senator Hagerty, you know, take their time to go over there, have a series of senior leadership meetings, went down to the Gaza border, toward some of the wreckage from the Hamas rockets. And as I said, just really send the signal to the Israelis that they have good friends in Washington.
I would characterize what these 4 months have brought in the following way, Victoria, and I'd like to get your thoughts on that as well as further amplification on particularly the internal politics in Israel at the moment, which are certainly in a state of high drama. Iran emboldened, our Arab allies in the region undermined, the Palestinians unleashed, and Israel beleaguered. Am I getting anything wrong in that characterization? I'm sure I could say it more starkly than that, but that seems to me to be a pretty powerful indictment of 4 months of U.S. policy.
Well, it is. And actually, no, I think you're spot on. But I mean, the problem I have with the situation is it doesn't have to be this way. There was a really remarkable op-ed in Newsweek yesterday, which I recommend to all your listeners, by a senior Emirati, Ali al-Nurami, who's very high up in their National Security Council equivalent. And he writes about how we cannot put the genie back in the bottle in terms of the Palestinians, and that what's going on with the Palestinians is being fueled by Iran, and that the Arabs should be standing with Israel. It's a remarkable statement, unimaginable 5 years ago. And now you have the Emiratis offering this in the American press. So your assessment of what the Biden administration is doing is entirely accurate. But it, as I said, does not have to be this way. The region doesn't want it.
More to the point, it wasn't this way 4 months ago. And the Emiratis, of course, and you were deeply involved in some of that diplomacy, having signed on to the Abraham Accords, which this State Department says they're not going to call those accords, by the way, has seemingly been involved in, as in so many areas, but particularly in this region, a kind of wrecking operation of what Donald Trump bequeathed to them.
It really is. And I mean, I think that's unfortunate because, you know, if you go back in history, if you look at the 1979 peace treaty between Israel and Egypt, or the 1994 treaty between Israel and Jordan, those were both shepherded by Democrat presidents. It was Jimmy Carter and Bill Clinton. You couldn't catch me saying a negative thing about them. I mean, they were monumental achievements for the United States, for Israel, for the region. And the developments between Egypt and Israel over the last 6 months, really, for the period since the Abraham Accords were signed, we've made more progress with the Israel-Egypt relationship than we've made since 1979. This is enormously beneficial. And you would think any U.S. administration would just be happy about it.
And instead, it seems particularly, Victoria, and we're going to have to take a break here in a moment, but in particular, what they are doing with this determined effort to sort of reiterate the mistakes of the Obama years with respect to Iran and to return to the status quo ante, the way things have always been with the Palestinians, failed though they may have been for almost all of that time. They seem, again, determined not to embrace, let alone endorse and build upon, but to take apart the framework that really made for, it seemed, a far more peaceable, at least the promise of it, a far more peaceable and enduring peace at that in the Middle East.
Well, I think so. And I think the kind of irony here is that the Abraham Accords really opened up a new path for the Palestinians, of all people. You know, the Palestinians who had been sold by their leadership the lie that the Arabs were coming to destroy Israel, that they tried before in 73, for example, and they were going to come back and Israel would be vanquished. We know that's not true now. Hard truth for the Palestinians, but also a reality check. Maybe they then could actually embrace reality and figure out what the future looks like for that group of people. But instead, the administration is going back to the unconditional aid. You might have seen that President Abbas sent $40,000 in cash to the family of a terrorist who killed two Israelis, leaving seven children behind. Yesterday this happened. That's what they're doing with the money. And it just doesn't help.
Pay to slay, as it's called, that's actually illegal, I think, under U.S. law. And we're going to have to talk about that, yes, a bit more, among other things, with Victoria Coates on the other side of this very short break. Stay tuned.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We are continuing our conversation with Dr. Victoria Coates, a senior fellow at the Center for Security Policy, who formerly served both Senator Ted Cruz and President Donald Trump in senior national security positions. And we are picking her brain about part of the world that she spent a lot of time on in those capacities, the Middle East. And Victoria, you just touched on something towards the end of that first block, and I want to come back to it. The Taylor Force Act prohibits U.S. funding from being used by the Palestinians to effectively reward terrorists or their families for murdering people like young Taylor Force, an American citizen killed by the Palestinians a few years back. Talk a bit about what the workaround is for the administration to that law. How can they get around it, and should they?
Well, I mean, personally, I'm not quite sure. I mean, I was involved in drafting the Taylor Force Act when I was a congressional aide, and then it passed when I was in the White House. And I think important to remember who Taylor was. He was a graduate student at Vanderbilt who was on a school trip to Israel, and they were down in Jaffa, and a Palestinian terrorist just pulled out a knife and stabbed him to death. And he was a veteran. I mean, a big guy. You know, this was not an easy thing to do. And his parents, Robbie and Stuart, made it their life's work to get this legislation passed and prohibit rewarding individuals like this terrorist for killing an American citizen. I mean, this guy didn't care if he was an American or an Israeli. He just saw this group of people as representative of what he considered his oppressors. So he didn't ask for anybody's passport.
Or just infidels, as the case may be. But this was the policy, and has been, and evidently still is the policy of the Palestinian Authority. And those are the guys we're told are the good guys. This isn't Hamas. This is the government to which we're pressing the Israelis to surrender still more territory and relinquish still more authority to. No?
Right. And it's, I mean, I think this has to be, for the American taxpayer, a very clear signal of where the Palestinian Authority stands. And, you know, we were very lucky at the center to get to partner this week with TIPP, with it's a polling outfit out of New Jersey, and they ran some questions for us, one of which was, do you support sending unconditional aid to the Palestinians, even if some of it may be diverted to support terrorism? And the American people, Democrats and Republicans alike, oppose this to the tune of 70%.
Understandably, right? This was evident in the Taylor Force Act itself. Yeah, no, it's crazy. Let me turn to one other thing that's crazy, and I'd like you to walk us through it. One of the things that has characterized the relationship between the United States and Israel over the years is that in time of need, we have tried to, at a minimum, resupply Israel when its stores of ordnance and weapons and so on have been depleted by its attacking enemies. That was not the case this time around. In the onslaught from Hamas in Gaza, with some 4,000 rockets raining down on Israel, which were to some extent intercepted by this remarkable system called the Iron Dome, there were people in the Congress who actually objected to replenishing the weapons that, you know, make the Iron Dome an effective anti-missile defense system. What's up with that, and what should we be doing to ensure that Israel can rely on us in this regard in the future?
Well, it was a very interesting situation with shades of 2015, when the then Obama administration refused an emergency Israeli request to replenish their precision-guided Hellfire missiles and slow-walked it while they were in the middle of a shooting war. And it's one of the reasons Israel had to come to a ceasefire with Hamas in August of 15, prematurely, and it's why Hamas then just spent the intervening years rebuilding and then attacked again. And as you said, Iron Dome was remarkably effective in both that interchange and in the most recent one, intercepting up to 90% of these rockets that Iran had supplied to Hamas, and Hamas then attacked Israel with. And you know, I think a number of leaders in Congress, including Senators Cruz and Senator Hagerty, were calling on the administration to preemptively reassure Israel that if they needed more of the Tamir interceptors, that the United States would support that request. Some of them are manufactured in Israel. Some can be manufactured here. They have a proposed joint site, which is what I wrote about, getting that up and running as quickly as possible here in the United States. I think it's going to be at Fort Bliss. But that is how you send the message to both Hamas and Iran that Israel is not alone. And we had the very shameful spectacle of the White House press secretary refusing to make that assurance. She just kept saying, I have nothing further for you on this. I have nothing further for you. How about, yeah, yes, we will do this. I mean, and you can see the Congress is moving quickly to meet an Israeli request for an additional $1 billion in security partnership, because that's what their constituents want them to do.
It may be moving quickly now. It was not moving at all in the event, as I recall. And indeed, there were members of the what's been called the Hamas caucus in the House of Representatives, the squad particularly, that were determined to block such, additional support for Israel when it was most immediately needed. And it does call to mind, one of the major precepts of Israeli security policy over the years is to try to be as self-sufficient in these regards as they can. And if ever they needed reinforcement for that point, it was this recent episode. Let me turn to one other thing that I know you're giving a lot of thought to and have over the years, Victoria Coates. We have a project at the Center for Security Policy, I'm very proud to say, led by our colleague, Dr. David Wormser, and you participate in it. Others of us do as well, aimed at fighting what we call global anti-Semitism. This scourge of the millennia seems now to be having a renaissance, not just in the Middle East, where Islamists, practice it relentlessly, but in Europe and even in the United States. What is going on in this regard? What's the wellspring of this? And how, in particular, is the idea that people are not really anti-Semites, they're just anti-Israel, offering a new sort of means of rationalizing or at least concealing the true character of what is, in fact, a racist, anti-Semitic agenda?
Well, and, at this point, I don't even want to dignify it with a term like anti-Semitism, which gives some kind of sort of quasi-intellectual gloss to this. I mean, this is Jew hatred. These are people who simply hate Jews and, by extension, Israel. And what's interesting is, as I said in the first segment, this is actually getting better in the Middle East, of all places. I mean, you have UAE opening a Holocaust memorial this week, and they pledging greater solidarity with the Jews. While in the United States, you had this shameful series of very violent attacks on Jews, which were proxy attacks on Israel. And again, they didn't ask for anybody's passport. They didn't care that they were Americans. All they cared about was trying to hurt Jews. And that is just a disgraceful, despicable, as you say, just scourge. And we have to call it out. My friend, Len Kordakovsky, dear friend from the State Department, actually a refugee from the Soviet Union, had to write a piece this week about the discrimination his children are facing because they're Jewish in New Jersey.
This is something I had a personal experience with in the old USSR, and was one of the reasons why my old boss, Scoop Jackson, and others were so intent on trying to enable Jews to leave it. And his family was among those who were able to. But what you're saying is, in our own country now, what he's saying, in our own country now, people are beyond just these instances of attacks, which fortunately were relatively few in number so far, but it bespeaks the sort of sense that it's okay to engage in this kind of behavior in America, does it not?
Well, and I would go back to what you were mentioning about the so-called squad. These are very vocal, very high-profile, media-savvy individuals from extremely specific congressional districts where this kind of behavior and rhetoric is acceptable. But the good news is it's a very, very small number. And you have, I think, quite courageous congressmen like Dean Phillips, who's, I believe, Minnesota 3, Ilhan Omar is Minnesota 5. So these are almost neighboring districts. And Dean Phillips called out the squad and said, we have to reject this. There's no place for anti-Semitism in the United States. And these people need to be encouraged. And the so-called squad needs to be called out.
Particularly by their fellow Democrats, no? I mean, this is the thing, is that we went through this exercise, as you recall very well, not so long ago, where there was supposed to be a resolution decrying what I believe Ilhan Omar had been doing in this vein, and turned into some watered-down resolution that denounced white supremacism or something. I mean, it's staggering how difficult the Democratic Party these days, Scoop Jackson's old party, I have to say, now finds it to hold these people accountable, as you rightly say, and more to the point, repudiates them when they should be. That's for sure. Victoria Coates, I had wanted to ask you about the state of the political situation in Israel. We touched on it at the beginning, but folks, we're going to have you back for that purpose, and also encourage everyone to stay tuned by checking at securefreedom.org for the upcoming webinar that Victoria will be doing, an interview with her old boss and our great friend, a keeper of the flame, Ted Cruz. That's a coming attraction, but we'll be talking to you, I'm sure, between times as well. Victoria, thank you for your time today and for your courtesy in making this particular interview possible. It's deeply appreciated. Next up, we'll speak with Sam Faddis about the enemy within, among other things, right here at home. That and more straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back, and a special welcome to our guest for the next two segments. He is Charles Sam Faddis, a remarkable contributor to, well, the war for the free world, a freedom fighter of the First Order, notably in the uniform of the United States Army for a time, then without a uniform, as an undercover operative of the Central Intelligence Agency's clandestine services. He has gone on to other things, notably a congressional candidacy. He is the author of a number of books, including Beyond Repair, The Rise and Fall of the CIA. He also served for a time as an assistant attorney general in Washington State. Sam Faddis, it's always good to have you with us, sir. Welcome back.
Great to be here as always, Frank. Thank you.
You are a resource on so many topics, Sam. I thought I'd just test the envelope here by asking you about, what do you make of the fact that we are now seemingly being subjected rather regularly to the phenomenon of cyber attacks for profit? There are cyber attacks of other kinds. Government entities are doing it to us and other bad actors. But now ransomware seems to be a thing, and it's affecting our healthcare sector, it's affecting our energy sector, it's affecting our food industry as well. Many of them with very, at least short-term, traumatic effects. Who's doing this sort of thing, Sam, as best we can tell, and how is it that they're getting away with it?
Well, it's done by a whole host of actors, and it's often done by, like so much of what we see these days, what we see are efforts by our adversaries in what are in sort of gray zones, meaning there are nation states behind it, but we sort of maintain the fiction that this is being done by some private entity. So the Chinese do this kind of thing with fishing fleets, right, that aren't really fishing fleets that work for them. There are lots of cyber actors in Russia, for instance, that are, yeah, they're sort of cyber militia, and they kind of independent of the state, but obviously in Russia, not really independent of the state. And then there's no clear line necessarily between all of those people and a pure profit motive. So yeah, you got sort of a soup of people that do this kind of thing. And unfortunately, it's a growth industry because we're more and more interconnected this way. And so it's kind of the equivalent of in the old days of taking hostages and then ransoming somebody back. And I don't think we're doing a particularly effective job of stopping them. So it's going to continue to grow.
Well, in fact, one can argue we're rewarding it by ransoming when the data is stolen. And you know, it seems as though everyone is taking away from it the idea that there will be more such lucre to be made. It's the Barbary Pirates of the modern era, I guess one might say.
Yep,
and
good
it's
analogy.
Going to have to take a different approach to stop it, I suppose. Sam, a number of other things that you've been writing about, notably on your terrific online resource and magazine. And I wanted to cover a couple of them with you in the course of the next couple of minutes. I know you are very focused on the phenomenon that's come to be called the enemies within. And of course, you, like me and many others of us, swore an oath to defend our Constitution against enemies, foreign and domestic. Some of your most important, I think, research and analysis has been with respect to, a Marxist character to some of these revolutionaries, whether it's Antifa or Black Lives Matter. You did a profile of a fellow that you call a sort of modern-day American Che Guevara. Tell us about him and how does he figure, or did he figure, in life and now perhaps in death, in the ambitions of those seeking to, it seems, destroy our country from within.
Right. So this is a character named Winston Smith, who went by the nickname Boogie, apparently, who was killed last Thursday, I think, a few days ago. He was a Marshals Task Force, U.S. Marshals Task Force, was attempting to apprehend him on felony weapons charges. He pulled a handgun. He also apparently opened fire on the Marshals because they found a whole bunch of shell casings and so forth in the car. And he was killed in return fire by law enforcement, as would seem appropriate under the circumstances. Well, what we were trying to illustrate with this is that this is not just a guy who's involved in criminal activity. This is a guy with a very loud, very extensive internet presence out there on social media, talking openly in crystal clear terms about revolution, armed conflict, killing the police, and using the word war, by which he means a race war, because he was African American, over and over and over. And this is not unique. This is where we are. We have, through not doing anything to stop it and by a lot of the rhetoric that's being pushed around, we now have significant numbers of individuals who are out there talking and preparing for armed conflict with the state, a revolution, insurrection. That's where we are. We're on the brink of it.
And there is a tradition in Marxist doctrine, is there not, of using things, class, of course, but also race, to divide the enemy camp and to seek to facilitate its destruction. Does this fit that sort of model? And is a race war now, unfortunately, increasingly in prospect, do you think, Sam?
Well, it is expressly Marxist, this doctrine. This is classic, particularly Maoist doctrine, right? Their contribution to this, to the madness of Marxist-Leninism, tear apart a society along every line you can find, race, ethnicity, tribe, everything. That's how you do it. So that's exactly what you're seeing. This is not a coincidence. And this didn't just happen. This is being done. I we've said this a lot at the end recently, you know, revolution. This is not a static thing. It accelerates. You pour more and more jet fuel on here. You got more and more people fired up, more and more people lapping up this ideology and actually believing it. And you're going to go from sporadic incidences of somebody shooting at a police officer to targeting police officers, police stations, and every other manifestation of the state, which is, of course, in and of itself, classic Marxist doctrine. That's the pattern. Right, you start taking out the police.
Yeah, and we've seen, particularly in connection with the Tulsa anniversary that President Biden spoke at, and in terms that, unfortunately, I'm afraid, could fan some of this. He talked about our systemic racism and the the unalterability of that in our country. It seemed very much to reinforce the kind of messaging that we were hearing from the National Black Panther Convention, if it were a convention, certainly an assemblage of some of these radicals. And you heard a lot there, Sam, from participants about killing whites, killing them, burying them, digging them up, killing them again, and so on from some of them. There was also a character that you identified, I believe, as Jelani Hussein, who is a prominent figure in a Muslim Brotherhood Front organization known as the Council on American Islamic Relations, I believe, in their Minneapolis, their Minnesota chapter. Talk a little bit about him and how, Sharia supremacists seem to be tapping into or tying up with, at least, these Marxists.
Well, there's no question that they are absolutely in the mix and they are part of this. And when I say in the mix, I don't mean to diminish it. That what folks need to understand is that what you see, I mean, first of all, the violence, the burning, the looting, these kinds of things, much more extensive than much of the media wants to admit. But it is also not spontaneous by any stretch of the imagination. There are very large, very organized groups behind this, have been now for a long time. And those include groups like CARE. And I was referencing specifically that the guy you were talking about is on the ground right now in Minneapolis in the street trying to get people to go out and burn and loot and commit acts of violence in response to the killing of this guy, Boogie Smith, who is a dangerous felon and openly advocating revolution and talking about how he is going to kill police officers and advising people on how to make Molotov cocktails. And this guy killed when he opens fire on law enforcement officers is now going to be the symbol that all of these groups are going to present. So this is not an innocent guy who was the victim of the police. He is a revolutionary and he is a martyr for the cause. And they're not, in fact, in much of the commentary online discussing him, he is referred to by the people who support him using the precise word revolutionary. They do not hide it. They consider that a compliment. So that they're exhorting people to die like him. He is a martyr for the cause.
And a rallying point in what this guy, Jelani Hussein, calls our streets. And we should make no mistake about it. This is the color revolution, I guess, that we've been anticipating for some time, spinning up for what seems to be a very concerted effort this summer, I fear. And we'll be following it closely with your help, Sam Faddis, among others. I'm very appreciative of your informed understanding of what we're confronting, in part because you've witnessed these kinds of revolutions. You've been involved in contending with them in various ways throughout your service to our country, notably with the Central Intelligence Agency. So it puts a special premium on our conversations with you, and I'm deeply grateful for the time that you give us each week for this kind of stocktaking and more. Sam, we have to take a short break, and when we come back, I want to visit with you about a report that you had at AND Magazine that caught my attention involving the shipment, apparently, of Iranian surface-to-surface missiles to Venezuela, including some believed perhaps to be of range to reach the southern coast of the United States. We'll talk about that with Sam Faddis some more right after this.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back, and we're visiting for another segment, I'm pleased to say, with Sam Faddis, a former Central Intelligence Agency operative undercover. He is also a profoundly prolific contributor to the public policy debate about the national security challenges of our time on a platform that he has created entitled andmagazine.com. I strongly urge you to make it one of your bookmark featured resources. Sam, we appreciate you being one of our featured resources here at Secure Freedom Radio. And I wanted to ask you about this report that you had about Iranian missiles apparently being shipped on two naval vessels of Iran to, we believe, Venezuela. Tell us what we think is aboard those ships and where they are in their progress towards Venezuela. And does it seem that anything is going to be done to interfere with?
So there are two Iranian naval vessels that have rounded the tip of Africa and are now into the Atlantic Ocean. I think they're 24 hours since they entered the Atlantic now, roughly. One of them is basically sort of a sea-based ship, kind of a converted large, I think it was originally an oil tanker, and it's been converted into basically a big cargo-type ship. The other is actually a combat vessel, the equivalent of, say, a U.S. Navy destroyer. So both of these vessels are on the way to Venezuela. That part has been discussed for some time. And then on the deck of the cargo vessel, if you will, visible on imagery, including commercial imagery, there are a number of fast attack boats, small, but still very dangerous vessels that the Iranians typically use in the Persian Gulf. And they carry small surface-to-surface missiles. They regularly harass U.S. Navy vessels with them. So that's all been established for some time. What we wrote about in the end was that, and I'm going to couch my words carefully here, because not because this is an issue of being evasive, but to the contrary, this is an issue of source protection. So we have information coming from sources inside of Iran with direct access to this topic, that in addition to the vessel, the boats that are visible on the deck of this cargo ship, that the cargo ship is carrying inside it surface-to-surface missiles. In other words, missiles that are not intended to be used on these boats. They are much larger surface-to-surface missiles to be erected in Venezuela, and then components that go with those. And that those components, many of them have been deliberately packed in containers, and so, in other words, disguised to. So if they do attempt to search the ship, somebody attempts to search the ship, they will not be readily able to identify with what is inside of these containers without having to basically start ripping everything apart. That's to make it harder for somebody to get to the truth. What we've also been told expressly is that the reason the Iranian combat vessel is there as an escort is not so much because anybody in Iran really anticipates getting into a gunfight with the U.S. Navy and winning, is because their calculation of Joe Biden is that that's all it will take to convince him that it's too risky to try to stop these ships at sea. That any prospect of even limited armed confrontation or even a standoff is something that the Biden administration doesn't have the backbone for, and therefore they're going to attempt to ignore this. Now, the Iranians have a whole, just to be clear, the Iranians have a whole bunch of different types of surface-to-surface missiles. Some of them are relatively short range. Some of them have ranges over 2,000 miles. And it is unclear, we don't know at end, which systems we're talking about. But it could, in fact, be a system that has the capacity to reach most of Florida, really. And one would think, if from a strategic standpoint, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense to go through the trouble and the risk of sending missiles to Venezuela, which then can basically target Caribbean islands. I mean, there are no threats to Venezuela surrounding it for which Venezuela needs surface-to-surface missiles to deal with those threats. That would be relevant. So
we could be looking.
That argues for a really bad situation.
Yeah, we could be looking at a Cuban missile crisis on Joe Biden's watch. And the possibility is, if not the certitude, that depending on how far advanced the Iranian nuclear weapons program actually is, that these missiles might be mated with such warheads when and if they become available. Thanks for keeping us clued up about this, Sam. I take it these ships are still at sea, and therefore it is still possible to effect an intercept, and I'm very hopeful that the administration will find the wherewithal to do that. Let me turn quickly to one last item that you've written about both at AND Magazine and contributed to another important website, the accountabilityinitiative.org. Sam, you have added some additional information about Dr. Anthony Fauci's role in all of this business of the Wuhan Institute of Virology and gain-of-function research there that may have contributed to, if not been directly responsible for, this so-called COVID-19 virus, or I think more accurately, Chinese Communist Party virus. Give us a quick précis of what you found.
Well, I mean, the state of play here is that there's been gain-of-function research going on at Wuhan, that Wuhan has Chinese military personnel there, that the Chinese interest in biological weapons is well-known and well-established, that Fauci is sending them money, that Fauci not only knew about all of this, but really was, this is the whole reason he was sending money there for that purpose. That's the only reason he was funding things there, was because he was getting stuff done there. He couldn't get done it elsewhere. He knew all of this. He lied about it. He's refused to disclose it to people. And that's where we are. You know, that we have a guy who's really been in bed with Communist Chinese on this for some time, and then has presented himself as something completely different to us.
And just to put a fine point on it, what he was in bed with the Chinese in doing, it now seems clear, was advancing the state of their art in the biological warfare space. And for a time, Sam, among the many things that one could mention in your CV was the danger that you helped try to protect our country against of biological or other weapons of mass destruction terrorism. You know a lot about this subject. To the extent that we're learning more by the day about the magnitude of this biological warfare program, illegal, by the way, biological warfare program in China. What are the implications that U.S. taxpayer dollars, U.S. scientists, and for that matter, Chinese scientists in this country have all seemingly been collaborating to intensify the danger that we face from a program that our friend Gordon Chang is now warning has had as its purpose for some time use devastatingly against our country, perhaps among others?
Well, as usual, Gordon has put his finger directly on the key issue, right? Anybody who studied this issue, who's been following this issue, has been focused on this issue. This issue has understood for many years, because the Chinese tell you out loud over and over and over, that they completely reject the entire, what they call Western notion of not using biological weapons in future conflict, that it's a trick of the imperialists to preserve their military advantage, and there's no way, no how, they're going to abide by that, and they continue, and we have known that, and we know about what they want to use this biological capability for, which is to kill their enemies, and we're at the top of their list. So that is the strategic environment in which Fauci and company are handing money to the Communist Chinese. So what are the implications? Well, there ought to be a massive federal investigation going on. Fauci ought to be facing criminal charges. I don't really like throwing around the word treason all the time, but it is hard to look at this and wonder how this doesn't constitute treason if you're cooperating with an enemy and helping them develop this capability. There are treaties saying things like, yeah, can't use biological weapons and develop an offensive biological weapons capability.
To which the Chinese Communist Party is a party.
And they are, so there's the implications for them, but we certainly are, and Fauci's a U.S. government official, and yet he's funneling money to the Chinese for what really seems like an effort to evade that treaty. That would seem to be a pretty big deal for a senior government official in the United States government to be helping somebody break that treaty to which the United States is a signatory. I mean, there ought to be massive law enforcement and legal implications. With this current administration, prospects for that, I think, are dismal, but we can always hope.
We can hope, and I think it's made more necessary in light, of course, of the death of 600 plus or so Americans and 3.5 million, I think, is the number now of others around the world. All of these add urgency to the kind of corrective action you're talking about. Sam Faddis, thank you for your time today. As always, we appreciate your giving us a second segment this week. It's very, very much appreciated. We appreciate your time as well, folks, and hope that you will be back with us for more of Secure Freedom Radio tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.